North Korea, Roseanne, presidential obstructions. You might have heard some headlines about those topics over the weekend. We have a few stories that maybe you didn't hear. I'm joined by our weekly panel to recap their favorite or most compelling stories of the weekend. Eric Hanberg is author and commissioner on the Metro Parks Board of Tacoma. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
Ruchika Altushyan is author of The Diversity Advantage, Fixing Gender Inequality in the Workplace. Welcome, Ruchika.
Thank you.
And Ken Jennings is still with us, Jeopardy winner, Jeopardy champ, author of Planet Funny. Thanks for hanging with us, Ken.
Still here.
So let's start with stories that most interested you. Eric, your top story you call hashtag Cockygate.
Yeah, hashtag Cockygate is a happened when a romance writer named Felina Hopkins, she put out a series of books about, you know, cocky senator, cocky cowboy, cocky heart surgeon, and this is a series of romance books, and she got that trademarked, the Cocky Brothers series. But then she started sending cease and desist letters to other, you know, the author of Cocky Fiance and things like that. And suddenly Amazon was taking down other titles because it had the word cocky in it. And the Romance Writers Association stepped in, the Authors Guild stepped in, and on Friday there was a hearing about this, and the judge did not think very highly of her arguments. But it's pretty funny to read the transcript of this as the judge is trying to understand, well, what do we mean by cocky? And, you know, he isn't wearing a shirt, but he has a stethoscope. Does that mean he's a doctor? her argument didn't hold a lot of water, and it seems like...
What did the case turn on? Why did the judge say?
Well, it comes down to you can't trademark a book title. You can trademark a book series.
What about cocky, right?
Possible. There's so many puns to be had in this situation, but you can't do that. And she was probably, in the words of one lawyer, even using trademark bullying. This always gets my goat a little bit because, you know, like Super Bowl, you know, I can't have a Super Bowl party without someone coming after me, or the Oscar party. But in this case, this is one where it seems like common English words should not be able to be copywritten. And it seems like the judge is going with that.
See, I did the thing, Ken. Mm-hmm. I had to make a joke.
It was
like the premise was
hockey, right?
But it was not. It wasn't even. It was just a pun. But the premise was potentially funny. And like if someone had to satisfy that.
But
Ken and I were talking earlier about comedy taking over our culture.
You made thousands of people laugh out in Radioland.
I could have done so much better. Twitter. I would have crafted it on Twitter. Any other reaction to Cockygate?
The series is called The Cocky Brothers?
It's the Cocker Brothers, like the Cocky series.
So are they all brothers? The heart surgeon is brother to the pilot?
To the cocky cowboy, to the cocky senator.
What a wacky family.
They're very cocky.
That's a crazy family, these guys.
So now, just to be clear, if I wrote my next book, it could have cocky in the title.
I think you're covered, is how it seems, right?
You're good.
I'm excited to hear that.
Speaking of romance, Ruchika, you have been thinking about Pride Month, which started last Friday in Seattle, and kind of contrasting that with the Singapore of your childhood.
That's right. So I grew up in Singapore, and we certainly did not have a Pride Month, although we've had different entities trying to bring some sort of march and some sort of celebration of same-sex couples and relationships. But yeah, growing up in Singapore, where series like Will and Grace were actually banned because Will is gay, and just not having that in our common lexicon, not really talking about, you know, LGBTQ issues or challenges or even same-sex marriage even being a thing. It still isn't. And now meeting so many Seattleites who are originally from Singapore who actually moved here, you know, so that they could have their marriage, you know, so that they could have a marriage and they could have children. And just moving to this like liberal West Coast, but also the United States being really open-minded about this as a concept. And then seeing the Supreme Court sort of decision this morning, it was really, really disheartening to see.
Which decision are you referring to?
So in Colorado, a baker was actually allowed to not serve and not prepare a cake for a same-sex, a gay wedding. And to see that decision being made was really, really disheartening because a lot of us, especially immigrants, people like me who come in here from Singapore, we're really excited about the idea that you really can be who you want to be and certainly have your views and yourself be respected. And then to have this be a reality here in the United States can feel like a big blow.
And there's a Washington State florist with a similar case who didn't want to do a gay wedding. So in Singapore, you're saying publicly these questions of sexuality and gender possibilities, they're not officially discussed, but how does that affect the private experience and discussion of them?
I think it's really hard for people, for couples who actually want to live in Singapore and want to be recognized. There's actually no legal way that they're couplehood is recognized. It's very, very tricky if they have children.
But that's the public end of it. Yeah.
Right, absolutely. Privately, I mean, these conversations happen. I mean, in any sort of arena where there is oppression, there is going to be a private way for these views to be expressed, and that very much exists. But just seeing people feel so oppressed, literally having to hide a side of their lives as they go into work, as they go out and meet other people, it's really, really disheartening to see. And seeing this become a thing in the United States, you know, in some ways it looks like we're actually taking steps backward is really, really concerning to me. But at the same time, Pride Month, you know, so I'm excited about that. So.
And Ken Jennings, we're talking about stories that were that came up over the weekend for us, and you've been following the disappearance of Melania Trump.
The non-story. It's the absence of a story.
Which is in itself.
It's a story.
Remarkable.
Like, I grew up with these, like, you know, Time Life Mysteries of the Unexplained books, and I love a good disappearance. Like, it's, you know, where's Amelia Earhart? Or, like, where's Jimmy Hoffa? Like, now I'm like, well, where's Melania Trump? Like, this is the best one of these ever. She's the first lady, and nobody's seen her in 3 weeks.
And the White House says she's going to appear this evening at a ceremony?
But with no press, so I don't know.
I thought there was a journalist that saw her a couple days ago.
Yeah, two journalists said they passed her in the hall. So that opens up all kinds of conspiracy theories. You know, why is she in the hall but not making public appearances? Could it be a lookalike? I love all these theories.
Hey, by the way, she was on Twitter. So doesn't that mean that she actually
in the voice of Donald Trump?
Yeah. So my wife Melania is fine. Like, the initial letters do say, "Please help me," which is very upsetting. But
my husband did not dictate this, and that's sad that you would ask. So one more story I wanted to bounce off you. The Baltimore Public Libraries have announced they're getting rid of overdue book fines. The new policy will erase $186,000 in penalties and reinstates membership for 13,000 borrowers whose cards had been blocked. However, the library will still charge for books that are never returned. The library will lose the roughly $100,000 fines it collects a year. Presumably, that can go to great library programs for the community. What do you think of the Baltimore move? Would you want to see that replicated here in the Seattle area?
I'll go first. I'm really excited about this, and I would love to see it happen. We know that these sorts of fines and things like that are a barrier that impact low-income, often communities of color. And for me, I mean, libraries was such a big part of my childhood and growing up and knowledge sharing. In today's world, in the digital age, it's a great meeting spot. I mean, I love the downtown public library, the Central Lending Library.
But wasn't an overdue book also part of your childhood experience?
No, I was always on time.
I say call it a marketing expense because it's worth it to get people back and using the library again. They're so vitally needed right now.
So one's going to defend the library fine, the overdue fine.
One thing I love about the library fines is you get these great stories where a book from 1896 is returned and you can be like, my great-great-grandfather now owes $67,000. Like, I mourn the loss of this kind of news story, which I deeply love.
Right. Those people get thrown into debtor's prison, right?
Well, 13,000 of them are apparently such scofflaws they can't use the Baltimore Library anymore. I can't believe that there's so many of these things.
Let them back in, that's what I say.
We called up the Seattle Public Library. In 2017, they collected not $186,000, $1 million in overdue fines from patrons. Again, left on the table. Let me make the case this way. It is the ultimate user fee. You are charging someone who has benefited from the service of the public library, who did not return the book. Who better to raise money for important community programs than that person?
The Snohomish County Library here does the same thing. They do not enforce fines, and they say that they save more in not having an enforcement mechanism than they would make from the fines. I don't know if that would
be true. There's a conservative, you know, economic argument.
Right. Small government and small libraries. That's what we want.
But what about the responsibility it taught us?
I'm happy to pay my fine, but if, you know, every 5 years a library wants to wipe the slate clean, I think that's a good service.
Yeah, and jokes aside, I mean, it's great to have this conversation, but imagine, you know, the library is, and for a lot of families, it is your only way of access to books, right? So the argument changes if we're kind of talking about, you know, someone who's trying to skirt the fines just because they can't be bothered versus someone for whom that access would actually matter.
That's what we need to do, is figure out, technology's got to help us figure out which are the people who just are scofflaws and no good nicks. And just charge those people.
I want technology to trace the books my kids check out, so I know, like, where in my daughter's closet this overdue book is. Like, to me, that's...
Put a chip on it.
Put a chip in it.
Why do these books not have chips? That's what
The amount of time I have spent trying to find the book. That's a really good call.
How about Netflix for books? Libraries can just ship us the books, and it'd be perfect.
Right.
I think there is something like, or that's more for ebooks, which, by the way, is a whole different conversation.
We're talking with our guest, our panel this week of you know, weekend watchers, Ruchika Tulshyan. She just gave me the thumbs up for the finally arriving at that pronunciation. Author of The Diversity Advantage: Fixing Gender Equality in the Workplace. And Eric Hanberg, author and commissioner on the Metro Parks Board of Tacoma. And Ken Jennings, Jeopardy dominator and author of Planet Funny: How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. Thanks, everybody, for sitting in. Good to see you.
Thank you.